Welcome to Mindset, Mood and Movement, a systemic approach to human behavior, performance and well-being. Our psychological, emotional and physical health are all connected. And my guests and I endeavor to share knowledge, strategies and tools for you to enrich your life and work. Welcome to Mindset, Mood and Movement, a systemic approach to human behavior, performance and well-being. Our psychological, emotional and physical health are all connected. And my guests and I endeavor to share knowledge, strategies and tools for you to enrich your life and work. Hello and welcome. Today we are looking at how to navigate a crisis of meaning by understanding archetypes. Now, don't worry, if you don't know what either of those factors are, crisis of meaning and archetypes, we are going to explain. But really, it's about helping you understand perhaps some of these really useful things that archetypes deliver and show us, and perhaps the shadow side of them as well. Actually, how we can use them if we're having a really difficult time and really struggling with meaning or life or what that might be. I'm delighted to join by my friend Greg Donaldson, who is a psychotherapist and all-round archetype genius. He knows a lot about this field. He's worked with me and is a great font of knowledge. And I have been privileged to learn about archetypes a lot. They are something which are an embodying description of something that transcends people. So I'm going to get Greg to explain more on this, but this is where we're going today, guys. So, and I'm going to hand over to Greg. Greg, welcome. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. An archetypal genius. I'm not sure I can handle that label. We'll see as we go on. Maybe in archetypal good enough genius.
That's all right with me. All right. The thing with archetypes that there is, we need to understand it. So I think the first thing I want to ask you, Greg, is could you define for us what an archetype is in your definition?
In my definition, an archetype is an energy that can come through and be transmitted through us. So when we talk about archetypes, we normally thinking about kind of Jung's work. And when you and part of Jung's work is talking about the collective unconscious. So this kind of idea that in the unconscious oneness of everyone, there's this sort of storage of different types of energies and archetypes that are playing through. So the idea being that, you know, it's like these are known parts when sometimes life throws us a lesson that actually, oh no, this is okay, maybe I need, this is the time that I'm going through with this archetype, I need to bring this into my life. Yeah, so it's difficult to explain if you're very realist in terms of materialistic. It's just about the physical reality, because there's something quite spiritual to it and unseen. It's really hard to describe what goes on in the unconscious, because it's not like a thing that we can measure or see. So archetypes are useful in terms of thinking about energies or themes that you can use to empower you or to notice what's going on in your life. So I come from a background of psychosynthesis, which is a form of or a map of psychotherapy that is born out of a combination of Jungian and Freudian kind of thought, and psychosynthesis kind of marries them both together and goes a little bit further in terms of using a creative way to think about your life. So in psychosynthesis, instead of archetypes, we talk about subpersonalities. We all have these subpersonalities or players in the orchestra within us that mostly go unconducted. So part of what therapy would be is about noticing that you have a conductor and that you need to step into relationship to all these different parts. In Jungian therapy, we can think about it more in terms of general themes and archetypes that are coming through that we might want to notice what's happening in our lives or what's going on around us, who we've got attracted to us.
Yeah, really interesting. Thank you. And a very eloquent description. And you're right, some people haven't come across archetypes or may have just loosely termed. And it is a big field, and we can also use other names. So yes, subpersonalities, I think character types, character traits, personality types. Many of us would have come across some of these descriptions to describe attributes and characteristics and behaviors and energies of people. And we all know it. It's a bit like some subtle ones, the playful one, the serious one. We've all heard these very general terms, but what Greg and I will go into is some of the more specific ones that are powerful, that are encapsulating, but also where they're helpful and not helpful. Now, my interpretation of an archetype is for me personally, is to understand where my whole mind, body, energy system is at. So if on a day I wake up and I'm feeling great, I might be in a sort of a powerful archetype and I can really meet the day. And I might have a certain label for that. Perhaps it's the king archetype or the explorer archetype. And some days I might wake up and it's not all going so well for me. And I might want to be the cave dweller archetype and hide away. And I think it's very helpful to make sense of these things. And as we said at the top of our show, that if you're having a crisis of some kind, or even a crisis of meaning at the deep level, really understanding yourself and these parts of yourself, which may or may not be working together, is really helpful. Greg, when we talk about understanding parts of ourself, for someone who's not really sure or hasn't really heard about the aspect of being different parts, could you go a little more into this? And I was going to caveat that because I do know when I work with people who don't know this, they say, I haven't heard of this. But then we have the phrase, like, part of me wants to do this and part of me doesn't. So we often speak in this part aspect anyway. But perhaps you could explain a little more from your professional understanding how these parts interrelate or don't interrelate so we can understand it better.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just to highlight, again, this is just like where I've come to in my own understanding and kind of the reading that I've done and the way that I find it useful to look at life. I come from a background of being an actor for 20 years. So there's a sense that there's something, without sounding pretentious, there's quite something quite shamanic in that art, actually, because what you're doing is you're jumping into different character aspects and then performing it on a stage or in front of a camera. And actually, part of what that's about is being able to fully immerse into another human being's experience and then being able to present that out, hopefully in an entertaining or useful way in the world. I already start from a place where I'm interested in the experience of the other and how that's possible for all of us. So you could talk about, recently there's been a TV program on BBC One starring Steve Coogan playing Jimmy Savile, right?
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to go off tangent here, but it's like when you think about people who have committed those sorts of crimes or people who've committed murder or whatever, actually, when you think about it in terms of the human experience, we're all capable of that. Like, we're all capable of going there. And as an actor, you can see that because it's like, well, yeah, how do you get into the mind of someone who is a pedophile or a murderer or whatever? And actually, you realize that there is always something traumatic or forgiving or something about any human experience and how they've got there. So that's my kind of upfront speech about it. But why I'm coming at it is because actually I feel like looking into parts and aspects of ourselves is just what I've always done in a way that I've always thought about it. Often.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm really intrigued because your backstory as an actor is something which is different. Certainly, I've done, I think I played maybe years ago, but I'm not very good. But being an actor, of course, the great actors of many TV shows and movies, they're captivating and great actors can step into these different roles and they're literally different people. And yet it's the same human being. So I think for me, I totally understand archetypes when I look at a great actor who plays perhaps a comedic part or a villain part or a gentle part. And you think, actually, it's the same human being who's got this skillfulness, who's tapping into something such as the villain or the good guy or whatever the part is. So you have an inside line on that. And when we think about those parts, because as an actor, they're, to do a job well, you have to absolutely embody that. You have to really be that part. Otherwise, it's see-through. You're not a great actor, right? But what about real life? So when we're dealing with stuff, how do those parts, certainly for you, work when you might need to be a certain part or archetype? How do you use that in your own life?
If you think about it, it is similar because it's like the Shakespearean thing of like all the world's a stage and we're just players in it. And actually, the thing that the ego loves the most is this sort of sense of safety, this reaching for, I am this, I am this. And when you think about that on a deeper level, it's not helpful, because it just, the language of that is like solidifying. It's making, turning you into an island. It's, you are becoming an identification of whatever the statement I am is. There was curious experiments done. I don't know if you know the kind of magician Aleister Crowley back in the days. He was this dark magician, but he used to do these sort of tests of like language, like taking things out, like not saying the word I to anything. And if he caught himself, he would cut himself or something like this. And then in the 70s, there was a guy called Robert Anton Wilson who tried a similar experiment. And basically, every time he used the word I, he would bite his thumb. And it was a kind of reminder of, yeah, anything that you attribute I am to becomes an identification. And when you've got identifications that you are a certain thing, then you start having very heavy opinions and convictions about life, which isn't that helpful. So he famously used to say, convictions cause convicts. So you become a prisoner of your own identifications. So the way, in answer to your question, the way I find it useful is to see it as a kind of ongoing theatrical event or filmic event, this life that we're passing through that is non-static. And so therefore, it's always going to be changing. So I'm going to have a cast of characters within me. And some of them are villains. And some of them are sweetness and light. And some of them are sorrowful martyrs. And some of them are complete, I don't know, materialists. And some of them are mystics. So this is the issue we face as being a human being with a kind of psychological awareness and a cast full of characters, is that actually we have this kind of paradoxical, oppositional characters within us. And a lot of the problem of life comes through thinking that I have to choose one and be one. And then once I found that one, I'll stick with that. My work as a psychotherapist is about, mostly or a lot, about discovering who people have got in their cast of characters and how perhaps they might understand a different way of working with them.
Yeah, that's so interesting, isn't it? Because my upbringing, my early upbringing, was that you were this name. You're the name that you're given, and this is what you do, and you follow that groove. That's what happens to a lot of us. And it's either for a crisis of meaning, or you, for some reason, you might seek therapy, or you have personal development. Somehow you've got into that space, or perhaps you've been on a yoga journey or something like that that's opened you up to this multiplicity. But you're absolutely right. And it reminds me of my old philosophy teacher, Anne. And she used to say, a sentence in the mind is a sentence indeed. And it's true, isn't it? And this is some of the problem stuff, which in my space of coaching and moving people beyond stuckness, where the I statement is often very rigid. I am X. Or I am this. I am this character, this person. And actually, there's something interesting about going to the shadow sides and the deeper parts where, what about the villain or the rebel, the person who's really got it all together, but there's a rebel in there? It's interesting, isn't it? So when we allow those parts to be seen, and the multiplicity, I think, is really interesting. I know Family Systems talks about this a lot as well, and I know you've spoken to me a lot about this in psychosynthesis. Having an understanding of who we are, as in all of the aspects of I, is absolutely fundamental. Because if we have an internal conflict, I don't like the rebel in me, or the serious part of me is boring, or whatever that thing is, we've got an issue, because it's you. It's still you, but what part of it? So thinking about these parts, if we are, I tell you what, I really wanted to speak to something here. So I work with a person, and again, with all my people, I alias them for their own privacy, but I work with this person, and they were displaying the archetype of a savior. So they're going around, and perhaps we could call that the hero archetype. So they were definitely taking care of things, very male domain, being the carer, being the savior. And we were doing some work around their levels of stress. And I was like, okay, did you know you're probably working from this archetype more than you think? and they hadn't even seen it. And on a behavioral level, it played out like this. Every one of their team came to them with a problem, and they and this person solved this these people's problems. So then they ended up coming to this person all the time. So their this my client's workload was through the roof. And he's like, why can't these people just do what they need to do? And I said, because you've set up a paradigm here. You've set up a savior paradigm, which always implicitly means that it is someone that needs to be saved. And the minute he shifted from that, the conscious shift out of, I'm not going to save this person. I'll be kind and I'll be caring, but I'm not going to save them. Oh my God, literally, it was a sea change, not only in the way they behave, but how people behave to them. And I found it so intriguing. Have you got an example of maybe someone, and alias them, of course, for privacy, but have you got an example of when you've seen an archetype at play that hasn't been helpful and you've helped someone work through it?
Probably millions, but I can't. I wanted to respond to your client, to be honest, because...
Yeah, please do then, yeah.
Yeah, because there's something interesting about that journey, really fascinating, like just even that moment that you're talking about there, where it feels like it's obvious you've hit a theme. It's like this guy's trying to save the world one person at a time, right? And then actually, so when you look at that, you can look at that in a few different ways. It's not just like random, the fact that he's doing that, right? There's a kind of... some habitual thing that's happened. So there's something, when you look at any archetype, you can look, or subpersonality, you can look at the kind of light side, positive, transpersonal side of it, the helpful side of it, but also there's going to be a shadow side to it. So it's really useful to think about that, I think, especially when you're talking about savior complex, and there's plenty of that going around in the kind of healing fields. It's in the sort of scene of psychotherapy and yoga and anything to do with healing the other is like a way to potentially be working on some level to healing your own family or healing your own history or healing the divide within you. And so yeah, it's great to hear that you can use that in terms of, look, there's an energy coming through here. And now let's look at why that and how that's developed. Because just noticing it doesn't necessarily change it, right? So there's always a sense like, oh, now I know that and I have that in mind. It's now I need to see where that's helping me in my life or not helping me. I certainly resonate with it in terms of my own journey as a therapist. There's a kind of sense that you set that up from the beginning. You say, you put your website up and you say, look, come to me and I'm going to help you with all your problems. Hopefully what you're not saying on your website is I'm going to fix all your problems. Because as soon as you start promising something like that, then you're in your kind of savior complex. But even if you don't write that on your website and someone comes to you and they're sat in front of you and they're saying that this is all the stuff that's going on in my life and this and that, that can you help me? The real answer is, well, yeah, I can walk alongside you and I can help you see what you need to see, but I'm not going to fix you. I'm not going to wave a magic wand and you're going to be better. I'm going to help you learn to step into relationship with yourself, and hopefully that will help you improve your life.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And yes, I think you're right. In the healing fields, in the yoga field, therapy, coaching, that there is a sense that if you haven't got your internal act together, then you could be coming from that archetype. I know my psychotherapy master was like, you need to take care of your own stuff before you do any work, right? That's absolute mandate in what we were trained in, because it was vital. It's really important to do your work yourself and make sure that you're conscious of your own stuff as well as you're working with clients.
Yeah, yeah. Just a sort of note to that as well, because there can be a big emphasis on, yeah, you've dealt with your own, obviously, but as being a human being, It's endless. You never get there, right? So yes, I agree that there does need to be a sense of, you know, where your triggers are and where your work is, but you're still walking alongside someone. You don't have to be like perfectly healed yourself, as long as you've got the reflective skill to know that's where you might get triggered and who you might work with. That might have a kind of bearing on who you work with.
Yeah, that's such a good point, isn't it? That self-awareness is so vital. And it makes you think of the culture that we're in. I grew up in school, and I think school's not that different today. It's very didactic. People tell you what to do. People tell you information. They give you all this stuff, as opposed to how you think. And I've come across so many people, personally and professionally, And if they're in the corporate workspace or the working field as opposed to entrepreneurship, there's often a sense that there's this sort of hierarchy that the manager or the senior manager, everyone tells everyone what to do. Whereas a more of a inquiry-led approach, what I would call a coaching approach, but it's an inquiry-led, would ask a question, say, so how come you're doing that and what's that for? Would be interested in pulling out of the other. Whereas a lot of our culture is about telling people what to do, which I know from my experience, certainly in as a man, a lot of that male domain has been about, we'll tell you what to do. And I do wonder, is that the sort of the power archetype of some kind coming through there in a general way? It's a question I don't know if we need to answer, but it's just a question that comes in my mind. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting when you talk in that way, because what I always think about life, how it's experienced outside in terms of it being a projection of what's going on inside. So you can look at the world. If you look at the world today and there's so much opposition and war, and you can see what's going on in Palestine and Israel and the Ukraine and Russia, and just in general human history, there's this like oppositional kind of like, I'm going to wipe you out kind of thing. And so why would that be any different to what's going on in our psyches? And it's a perfect example, actually, really, of what you're saying is, look at all these structures that we have that are to do with management and hierarchy. It's exactly the same thing that goes on in our heads. And so that's why we love it, because we're building the same things that go on in our heads. But actually, now we're coming much more round to this idea of living in a place where it is much more of a kind of, where it isn't more of a curious discussion. And hopefully that's how it is in our heads. Do you know what I mean? And that's how we start to realize that we're living with a kind of the board members of our own psyches. And so we have to find ways to communicate with them. We can't just go in there and bang our fist on the table and say, this is how it is from now on. But mostly all of us do live in a dictatorship or a cult. That's one of my sort of favorite ways of thinking about it, is actually we're all in a cult and we don't know we are, because we've signed up. And so we're agreeing to all the kind of the rules of how to be and how to operate. And it's only when we come up against possibly an existential crisis or a place where, oh my God, I can't find any more meaning in my life right now, is because the board members have all gone on strike because they don't want to live in a dictatorship anymore. So it's a natural reaction is to go into some sort of melancholy or meaninglessness.
That's so interesting, isn't it? And many of us might be hearing this thinking, really? Is that how it rolls? Is that actually how the mind is? But we do know it, don't we? We know, of course, a classic example is perhaps having a few too many drinks, alcoholic drinks. So the person who's got their act together, maybe works hard, perhaps a parent, does all the really good stuff. Get a couple of glasses of wine or beers and suddenly they're like, yeah, I don't care. And this is a very different character. Now, we could talk about inhibition, how the brain works, and we won't get caught up in that. But what is interesting, I think, is that sometimes those shifts, whether it's a chemical shift or whether it's an existential shift, it brings a part forward or an archetype forward that may be in the recesses. And I find it very interesting that you're right. There's this sort of perhaps leader in our minds, and it could be, I don't know, let's say it's me, I'll take my example, Sal, the coach, and it's diligent and this, that, and the other, and really committed to what I do. Sometimes I'm just a great big kid. I just like to play and I'll do really playful things. And I can be multiple things. And I've had the fortune of great teachers and therapists to help me through that and understand that better. But I think when we don't have a clue of this stuff, it can be overwhelming. But what I would say is, and I'm going to cycle back to your original description, a really good movie or play, if you like the deck, the boards, as they say, a really good movie has a lot of characters in it. And it's got all the parts, hasn't it? It's got to have all the parts. And I think we are so capable of having all these archetypal parts. And perhaps if we suppress them and not understand them because we're scared of it, we're in deep trouble. And then you're absolutely bang on. This crisis of meaning can come up because actually it's an internal crisis. I'm going to speak to the word crisis as well, because I'm an etymology fan. Etymology, the roots of words. Krisis is the Greek. It means to make a decision. It's a decision point. So we use crisis in our current language as if, as in the word catastrophe, but it's incorrect. So if we really are having a true crisis of meaning, we need to make a decision. And that might look like, I'm not going to be a Mr. Boring anymore. I'm not going to be a hero archetype anymore. Or I'm not going to be a victim archetype anymore. Could be one of these things that is, okay, that's got to shatter because there's other parts that are going to come through. Now, Greg, I know you're super skilled at this. How do we allow those other parts to come through? And of course, through a skilled psychotherapist is a vital way. But if someone's is listening now and thinking, okay, I get the sense of this, I've got the sense of the different versions of me, how do we start to allow those parts of us to come through on even on a daily basis?
Good question. I think we have to be careful not to overdo it, because I remember myself when I first started doing my psychotherapy training, and there was like one exercise where you close your eyes and you get on a bus, and you're on a bus, and you realize that you're on a bus with all these characters on the bus. And then at some point it gets revealed that they are you, they're parts of you, right? And so then when you get off the bus, the idea is that you stand there and then you like label them as they go, oh, look, there's Mr. Thingy. Oh, yeah, oh, look, there's Mr. Depressed. Oh, yeah, there's the magician. There's the pragmatist. There's all these. But what starts to happen is you can get overwhelmed with this sort of sense of, oh, my God, am I just going to go crazy? Because I've got like all of these archetypes or subpersonalities in my head. So my first invitation would be, really, it's only really crisis that actually calls you into working or understanding these parts of yourself, because they're the parts that are necessarily not quite working. They're the part, or they're the parts that are you're depressing or pressing away. That's what I always think about depression, is that actually depression is, if you think about it, you're talking about etymology. I mean, I don't know the meaning of that word, but actually, if you get into actually what how it sounds, depressed, I'm pressing down. I'm pressing away a part of myself. If you press away your vitality or some aspects of you that you were taught in your family cult wasn't acceptable, then you become depressed. So there are simple ways to find out what you might be hiding away or depressing is simply write. Put a line, get an A4 piece of paper, write a line down the middle, and on the left-hand side, write me, and on the right-hand side, write not me, okay? And then in the column of the me column, just write down everything you identify yourself as. I'm this, I'm this, I'm this, I'm this, I'm this. List it all out, and then have a really close look at that. And then in the not me column, look at the absolute opposite of what you've written down and try and equate them up. And that's not to say that you've got all of this stuff in the not me waiting for you to be expressed, but there's a pretty big clue that there's something that you don't think you are in that not me column. And that is a very simple way to find out actually some what you might need to learn to bring out in your life, what you might need to bring. For instance, if you are sensible, I am sensible. In your not me, it might be I am careless, or I am spontaneous. Or so you find that, and then it's like you go, all right, so it's pretty obvious that on some level, I'm not allowing myself to be careless or spontaneous. So how am I going to do? How am I going to? So the next thing is to think about this in terms of, so that line down the middle, What that actually represents in psychological terms is a kind of a little bit like a wall, actually. And I'm coming back to Israel and Palestine. It's like there's a wall usually between what we think we are and what we think we're not. And everything that we think we're not gets put in the not side, right? And locked down in there. And then what we do is we put guards on that little wall, or that massive wall, that are basically put there in order to keep the equilibrium, right? You are allowed to be this, but you're not allowed to be that. And so then someone depressed or having a crisis of meaning comes into therapy, and they just basically want you to strengthen that wall for them. Usually they're like, I just want to feel better about who I think I am. And actually, the way I see it is, let's find out who you're not and celebrate that as well. But the only way to do that is by digging under the wall and creating little escape hatches. And then so you start to irrigate. You start to irrigate the energy. So you bring across spontaneity. You bring across a carelessness. You can still be sensible, but you're irrigating the conscious mind with a little bit more other energy from the not allowed side. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I love that. I know I've been privy to this work. It's fantastic. What my thought comes up in a sort of straight away to that is, yeah, but what if I do something bad? So let's just say you've got the sensible archetype, whatever that is. Let's call it sensible. And then you've got the spontaneous or the reckless. And it could be easy to think, oh my God, but I can't be reckless. And maybe I've got a family or got work or business and I can't do that. So there can be some, I sense some fear around that, which I can only guess is that I don't understand it. That's what's coming up in my mind. So if there's fear coming up, there's a lack of trust. And if there's a lack of trust, it's because I don't understand it and I don't feel I can deal with it, which I wonder how you might answer to that. So if a person's having the same question, what if I do let the reckless part come up when I'm actually quite sensible and I need to be, and I'm scared of that part, but part of me does want to be a little bit reckless sometimes. How would you help that person navigate maybe that fear I've named? What would you do with that?
Well, the first thing that I would say to them is that it would be more dangerous not to let that part out or not to irrigate that energy across. Because I don't know if you've ever experienced this in your own life. I certainly have. When I ignore a part of myself or something that needs to be expressed, I either get depressed and feel the crisis of meaning, or I act out. This part that's being depressed or kept on the other side will just break the wall down and come through and take over. And that's usually why people are coming to therapy, is because something like that has happened. The reckless part of them has come out and said, I've had enough of this. I'm not living in this cult anymore. I'm going to go and wreck the whole village, and comes out into the psychological village and starts like punching everyone and dragging everyone through the streets. And it's like, the sensible part goes, what's happened? And then they come to therapy in order to like have the wall fixed again and the recklessness put on the other side. So of course, you're exactly right. It is a fearful situation, because it's not one or the other. It's not like I am sensible and now I need to be reckless. It's like, what would you do if you mixed sensibleness with recklessness? What would you find in that? Probably some kind of magical potion that creates enough sort of spontaneity and enough aliveness that it brings a kind of fear, but it also brings an aliveness, which is an antidote to meaninglessness, right? So when, I think this is another part of what we're talking about in terms of the crisis of meaning, is that actually usually that comes from being too safe to some respect, because the wall is too well defined. So actually when you add in what I call stepping over the edge, then it needs to feel like stepping over the edge. So for someone who is very identified with their being sensible, standing on the side of a mountain with a parachute is going to feel like I'm going to die. This is it. I've reached the end. So that feels challenging. And I'm not saying literally you're standing on the edge of a mountain, but it feels like to bring in a bit of like spontaneity may feel like standing on the edge of a cliff or a mountain. And so am I going to fly? Am I going to jump? And will the parachute take me? Or am I going to plummet and die? And the ego will always want to go for the safer option, will always want to just head to that place.
So interesting, isn't it? I love what you said there. I love that idea of this irrigation. And I'm just imagining the sensible part in me and then perhaps the reckless or the not sensible part. And that irrigation, you're right. It's so easy to get caught up in a black and white mindset or binary mindset. It's either this or that. I'm either sensible or reckless. And when actually life doesn't really work like that, because if you have all these parts in you, all these archetypal parts in you, then it's probably more of one part and less of one part, like a sort of a graduation. And I love what you said about the irrigation and what might happen. Because, of course, that's a brand new piece of chemistry. Psychological chemistry is going on there. It's something magical. And if you're stuck, if you have a crisis and this something needs to change, then we actually do need something magical to happen there. And that's a really beautiful way of describing it. That really struck me, so thank you. I think one thing I think about the ego, and again, ego gets a bad rap. I used to be in yoga for a lot, and people say, oh, yeah, get rid of the ego. I'm like, why would you do that? We all need the ego. There's nothing wrong with the ego, but I think ego, in my experience, is actually quite a habitual thing. It's like we have a habit of being the I that I know, whether that's the serious person or the coach or the joker or the playboy or whatever the thing is that's your dominant type. And we get quite, it's like a habit itself, like smoking or going to the gym, whatever habit, good or bad, or healthy or unhealthy, our ego feels like it can be a habit. And there's a default. So if we look at brain science, it's always the path of least resistance. It's go to what you know. So there's no surprise that the habit repeats, even if it isn't helpful. And what might happen if we were to become clear on archetypes? A question has come up in my mind. I'm going to give you an example. I worked with a client and she was having a real problem with communication with other people. And she felt like there was a lot of dominating characters in the place she was working in her company. And we spoke about what archetype, what version of you shows up at the conversation. And it was actually a bit like a fighter, but actually more of a victim, as if something's going to get, I'm going to get a beating here. I'm going to get a verbal beating. So she was already on the defense. So neurologically, she's in a flight state. She's already prepped and ready. And instead of a conversation, it was always an argument. That was her belief pattern. So we explored a little bit about the archetypes of the victim and it's always happening to me and what that might be. And we played around what version of you could step up to those conversations differently. And we looked at the queen archetype, and this was her term, not mine, her queen. I got her to describe what her queen archetype was. And it was more of a powerful state, more of a person who had some power, some skill, some strength, as opposed to a smaller sort of squashed down person. And it seems to help this person really well. But I know you are very clear on this, that we have to be careful of the archetype and perhaps the shadow and the light. So using our queen analogy, and I know you've said this to me before, but what might we want to look out for if we step into that without really thinking it through? What type of queens might there be?
This is it. I think I know where you're getting at. If you look at actually royalty and dictatorships throughout the ages, you can see where that kind of sovereign power can be also abusive or shadow. It's like, I am the absolute truth. I am the connection to God. I think royal archetypes are really useful in terms of like king, queen, even like in the tarot with the sort of prince and princess. It's like a sort of sense of, oh yeah, you're on your way. You're on this journey to your kingdom or to your queendom. But that's not to say also that the more kind of sort of like, if you think about like in the Queen of Swords, which is in a tarot deck, is about like becoming like absolutely sharp, mentally focused. And then at work, for instance, with your client, it's not about her needing to become like, oh, the friendly queen that will like look after everyone. It might be the queen that has to be like, looks at one eye and kind of sees what her domain. And then the other eye is purely cold eye. No, she can see what needs to happen, off with their heads. I can't hire these people anymore. Well, look, they're absolutely useless. I need to get rid of them. And that's useful, but it's still can be powerful. And it's not like the Queen of Cups, for instance, that would be, I am the loving queen, the loving mother of creativity. And this is what I need to imbibe in my people. This sort of sense of let's all share and I will share my wealth and all this kind of stuff, which is another great archetype. So yeah, you're right. There has to be kind of specificity to these kind of thinking about these archetypes and actually what they might offer in their shadow as well that could get attached to that power, right? That's why you might also need the fool in there to come in and tell the truth with humor in case the king or queen get carried away with their own sense of power.
That's, yeah, it's such an interesting point, is it? Because I'm very visual, so if you can play along, I'm imagining a stage, because Greg being an actor, and on that stage, the actor at that moment steps forward and does their lines and delivers their piece. And then, of course, if it's all very serious and the idea of the performance is to be quite comedic, you might get someone butt in and make an absolute joke of them. And it could be the joker or the playful one or whatever it is. And of course, if we don't allow those aspects of our mind to step forth and step back, to graduate in and graduate out and to balance, then we're slipping to a very uniform way, aren't we? As in one. And of course, the problem with one is that if we need to be a certain way, because we always need to be a different way, is you don't want to be at work how you are at home. If you lead at work, you don't walk into the house and go, everybody, dinner at 6. And it's like, you're not an MD, you're a dad or a mum or something. Or if you're playing with your kids, you don't become like a different archetype that's not helpful rather than a dad archetype or mum archetype. So I think there's a skillfulness, isn't there, about what version of me, what archetype, what aspect of me needs to come forward at this time. And I think that's what I've learned from this work, is that if we don't understand what's needed at this time, either a habit will happen, which will be an old habit and perhaps an unhelpful one, or if it's predicated on fear or something like that, it might just become a defender, batting off everyone, instead of an explorer who's, wow, this is a brand new exciting thing. I've no idea what's going to happen. So I think there's a skillfulness, isn't there, about if we're in a crisis of meaning, if we're really struggling with where we're at, how we can embody and tune into archetypes, but know what's appropriate now. And maybe it's a bit of a blend. It's like the queen and the joker need to come together to the meeting. Or perhaps it's there's the sage archetype, one of my favorites. It's kind of stuff I like to do. But the sage archetype, of course, is all wisdom and light. But what about the explorer who's like, well, I don't know. Let's go have a look. So if we bring forth the right balancing, we're going to shift. And if it is a crisis of meaning, you need to make a choice. And it's which one are you going to choose, or which several are you going to choose to come forward? I'm interested to know, Greg, what are your, I know there's some, if we look at Carl Jung's work and this guy, we'll put some links in the show notes, but there's some overarching archetypes, aren't there? Are there any that really stand out for you that are helpful when we're going through a crisis?
Yes, there are. There's a brilliant book by Rod Boothroyd called Warrior, Magician, Lover and King. And that's a really useful way of looking at those kind of four archetypes, especially for men. I think there's the same version for women as well. But it's about setting up your council, if you like. So it's like the king is the overall purpose holder. It's like, look at my life and this is what I want to experience. This is how I want my life to be. These are my values. And then you go about with the team of warrior, magician and lover. So you've got your kind of warrior who will go out into the world and do the whole kind of career thing or basically work out a way to be in the world, make sure that you're fed and housed and taken care of. The magician is more like the kind of puzzle. He's the one that kind of comes up with the solutions to the puzzles of life. You give him the kind of, oh, how do I need to think about this problem, or what's this thing that's going on in my life? And the magician can help with that. And then the lover is about like how you do relationships. It's not like, how am I going to, can I bring intimacy into my relationships? Not just romantic relationships, but like all relationships. And so you've got these amazing team of archetypes there led by the king. The problem that we see a lot is that the king abdicates and just puts his feet up, and then those other three, they go off and just do their own thing. So if they don't have a leader, then they can start working for their own causes, which then leads into another whole load of other trouble. So that's one lens you could look at it through. Another lens that I like to look at things through is Caroline Miss. She talks about archetypes and these kind of contracts that we come into this life with and lessons to learn, right? And she's got this idea that there are four archetypes that we all share. Now, two of them you might find quite surprising, right? So you already mentioned the victim archetype, and the other one is the prostitute, right? And it's really, I find that so fascinating, because actually no one wants to identify themselves as having a victim archetype, but actually we've all suffered, right? It's like if you go into sort of like the Buddhist teachings, it's the first law of is like life is suffering, right? And so And so the victim archetype speaks to that in terms of, yeah, we all have suffering in our lives, no matter what that looks like. Some of it might be more extreme in terms of like childhood abuse and childhood trauma, but whatever happens to us, we come through our childhood and we're traumatized to some level, right? You could say with a small t, but it's like you might get ignored, or you just being born, traumatic event, right? So the thing about the victim archetype is if you get identified with that one, then actually what you attract to you are the archetypes. This is talking about the triangle, the victim triangle. You get into this kind of, you'll get people who are going to come and rescue you out of that, or you're going to get people who are come your sort of perpetrator, become the person that's bullying you, right? So then that circle of those three archetypes gets to just play along. But then on another level, think about that in terms of that's an internal triangle. It's like when I'm in my victim, then who comes along? The person in me that thinks they know better and that they should get rid of this victim and stand up for themselves. So that might be useful, but it also might not be useful. So I can do a lot of work with people around how to almost like build. What I get people to do is I get them to build a statue in their own mind to the victim, right? It's, yeah, you make it big and gold and shiny and massive, as big as you like, and then bow down to it and give it everything like, yes, you have suffered. And then get up and walk away from it, right? And you know it exists. It's there in your psyche. But now I'm going to go over here and do this. Too many people set up camp at the bottom of that statue and go, I'm just going to live here because this is all I need, actually. It's just like my enjoyment of this suffering. When I say enjoyment of suffering, it's, that comes from the sort of tantric view of like all of these demons that we have, or all of these archetypes that we can, even if they're in the shadow side, there's some pleasure we're getting out of it. There's such a pleasure of being a victim. It's like I'm eating suffering for breakfast. It's like I get something from that. So all the work is find interesting is just about, yeah, whatever's there, notice it and honor it and find out why you need to honor it. And then coming back to what you were saying about transitioning, learn how to become a little bit more of the witness or the conductor so you can direct the energies through. It's like, oh, now I feel the rebel coming through, or if Mr. Sensible needs to come back. Or like a mixture of the two, which creates an alchemy kind of skillful will. You know what I mean? We'd say in psychosynthesis, once you bring love and will together, you get this skillful will. And so you could say the same about archetypes when they maybe start working together, collaborating together, like the king, the warrior, the lover, magician thing. Suddenly you get this alchemy of expansion and creativity, you know?
Beautiful, beautifully put. It's images in my mind. I'm very image led. I've got this because being an actor, it's all on stage right now. But I've got this image of all these parts, all these archetypes, and the spotlight is shining down on one. But if you're cool, you can be a lighting conductor as well, and you shine the light on different archetypes. You might be brighter on the king, a little lighter on the lover, or brighter on the warrior archetype. And you can start to play and brighten up and add people in. It's fascinating, isn't it? Of course, it's a huge field, and we've obviously touched on it to generalize and to obviously give everyone a feel. And I think in a way, perhaps some understanding that you're way more than perhaps just the identity you might be attached to. And that's a good thing. That's a healthy thing. You can be way more. And when you start to gently understand these aspects of self, and I've done a lot of work on this myself, understanding the bits that we've hidden, the bits that are shameful, the bits you don't like or don't understand. When we start to bring everyone in the room, in the mind, you start to go, oh, okay, to all these parts. And instead of it being terrorizing or scary, you start to understand it's more of a like a collage or a hologram of sorts, where this beautiful contrasting nature of all these parts can actually reside together. But we need the light of awareness to understand this, and we need the light of awareness to bring things together, and as you say, Greg, to alchemize, to really use that.
Cool.
Take a breath. Greg, thank you for your time, your knowledge, and your thoughts, and sharing with us about archetypes and how they may help. If you're struggling with crisis of meaning, perhaps I invite you to really feel this, that there's something possibly coming through And it's actually a point of decision and change, not necessarily something terrible. And I think this is such a thing I've learned from my psychotherapeutic background, in my coaching work, and Greg, of course, has shared a lot with me, that actually a difficult time isn't necessarily bad. It could be the right catalyst for change. So it can be like, okay, I'm really struggling right now. That's telling me something's shifting, as opposed to I got to get rid of it. So I hope that this is an inspiring, insightful line of thinking that you can take forward. And of course, we will leave Greg's details in the show notes. We'll add some bits around the books Greg mentioned. And yeah, perhaps when you go away from this session, sit for a second, get that pen and paper out, draw the line down the middle. Who are you? And who are you not? I just get super interested in that, because what we don't look at is often really insightful. So it's an amazing, simple, yeah, elegant exercise Greg's given us. Thank you, dear listener. Thank you, Greg, for your time and your wisdom.
Pleasure.
And I'll talk to you on the next one. Take care. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe. And if a friend would benefit from hearing this, do send it on to them as well. If you would like to get in touch yourself, then you can go to my website, which is saljefferies.com, spelled SaljeffreiES, saljefferies.com. Hit the Get in Touch link, and there you can send me a direct message. If you'd like to go one step further and learn whether coaching can help you overcome a challenge or a block in your life, then do reach out, and I offer a call where we can discuss how this may be able to help you. Until the next time, take care.